Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
He is director of the Robert Levy Center for Constitutional Studies at Cato. He's written a new book, which looks pretty good. Supreme Disorder is the name of the book. I want to welcome Ilya Shapiro. You've seen him on Fox. He writes for a lot of outlets. Ilya, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back, and happy to take a break while Dick Durbin is talking about his constituents who are worried about losing their health care coverage.
You know, like she's being made the czar of health care coverage or something, right?
This is like a markup of the Health and Human Services Committee, I think.
It really is. I mean, all we're talking about is Affordable Care Act or overturning Roe v. Wade, and I think Judge Barrett. I think she's holding up well. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, she's just so disarming. You said
yes.
Winsome. I think that's right. I mean, gracious. Just
yes.
You know, shows that she's not just really smart, but just personable and poised. I can understand why the Democrats are running on Obamacare and not attacking her credentials.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, when the American Bar Association said she's well qualified and goes on to talk about how great she is, I think it's kind of a hard sell. Hey, let's do what most people do last. Let's do it first. You've got a new book out. I just saw it on the website, Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations and the Politics of America's Highest Court. Give me the genesis of the book. Give us a quick outline about it, and how can we get it?
Right. Well, 2 years ago, after we had the last round of hearings for Brett Kavanaugh, I thought to myself, I've been wanting to write a book about the Supreme Court, and I thought, these hearings, the confirmation process, it is just toxic. It's the same part of the same toxic cloud that's enveloped the rest of public discourse.
Mm.
When did this all start? How has politics played a role? What can we do about it? And, it didn't start with Kavanaugh or Clarence Thomas or even Robert Bork.
Mm-hmm.
Politics has been part of the nomination confirmation process from the very beginning. I mean, you have a president who's a politician making nominations, senators who are politicians voting on them. George Washington had a nominee rejected. Lots of our presidents have had trouble of various kinds. And, whether it's slavery or industrial age regulation or the New Deal, I mean, politics has played a role in all sorts of ways. And that what's different now isn't, Twitter or the 24/7 media cycle or what have you. It's that you have divergent interpretive theories mapping onto partisan preference at a time when the parties are more ideologically sorted than at least the Civil War. And so you're going to have these big battles. But yeah, if you go to whether you go to Amazon, whether you go to SupremeDisorder.com, you can buy it in various forms. And at SupremeDisorder.com, you can download statistics and historical nuggets about all of these confirmations.
Good. I'm looking forward to reading it. Supreme Disorder. I can't wait. This you mentioned the spectacle, the whole spectacle, and particularly, a lot of people remember the Bork disaster, Judge Thomas, more recently with Brett Kavanaugh. I think, as you said, disarming is how Judge Barrett is. I think it's almost stopping people in their tracks when they're going to get nasty about something. I can see the wheels turning and they think better of it before they go down that path. But this hasn't always been the case, right? We haven't done this public hearing on TV, hecklers in the crowd. That hasn't always been the way it's been held, right?
Yeah, there's been a ratcheting up of tensions, certainly. I mean, for one thing, we didn't have hearings all the way back. 1916 were the first hearings. Probably the most controversial nominee, Louis Brandeis, the first Jewish nominee, and was a kind of a a crusading progressive, nominated by Woodrow Wilson in a presidential election year. It took nearly 5 months to confirm him, longer than anyone else.
Wow.
Hugely controversial. But the nominee himself did not testify. That was seen as unseemly. We didn't start having nominees testify regularly until the 50s or so. And, you know, it didn't really start getting bad until Bork in 1987. And then we've seen a ratcheting up of the judicial wars and of the heat presented at these hearings. I actually just wrote a piece building on something I said in my book, saying that at this point, the cost to our public discourse and to the Supreme Court is greater than any benefit we get from these public hearings. So,
talk about that a little bit. How do you view that, Ilya? What, when you say that, what is the cost? What is it doing to us to go through these spectacles?
Well, sure, it's making the nominees look like politicians or look like political actors and look like the considerations that Supreme Court justices use in considering their cases to be the same as what legislators, congressmen use in deciding how to vote. And that's just not the case. It muddies up the whole process, and we don't learn anything about the nominee. We don't learn anything about the law. And everyone's playing from their own playbook. The nominee talks a lot, sounds smart and nice, and doesn't say much of anything. And the senators from the party of the president try to toss softballs and make the nominees look good, and the opposing party tries to ask gotcha questions or come up with B-roll for their reelection campaign. So it really, you know, you can have hearings behind closed doors. You can certainly debate the merits, whether on the floor of the Senate or on talk radio and the newspapers and what have you. But having the nominees appear and participate in that spectacle, I really don't think it does anything for anyone.
Yeah. I don't know who said it, but I was listening to one of the channels in a break, and they said that certainly not having viewers/spectators in the room has made this process way more not only palpable but easier to manage than during the Kavanaugh hearings, when there was like every 5 minutes somebody would start screaming, you know, incoherently in the room. Is that a simple step that could be made, and just don't let people come in as spectators?
That's part of it, and certainly we didn't really have protesters, Kavanaugh's an outlier in that respect. I mean, Justice Thomas was protested, I suppose, outside the Senate buildings, but nothing inside the room. But really, most of the disruption, most of the problem, as I've described, is this dynamic with the senators responding to the political incentives they face. So it's not so much, I mean, yeah, the protesters are a problem that could be dealt with, but it's really the politicians acting from their political incentives to, you know, make this, as we were discussing, make this hearing about the Affordable Care Act and the presidential election rather than, you know, a sober discussion of legal philosophy that could be educational for high school students or what have you. You're not really getting that.
Yeah. I'm wondering if, again, I don't know that this is necessary or even wise, but, you know, the big controversy right now on the campaign trail is whether or not Vice President Biden, if elected, would, you know, pack the court, like adding the number of justices on the court. Some have suggested the way to stop that conversation, that it really hasn't been successful, right? It's been nine judges for 150 years. Been quite a while, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 150.
Some are saying we should actually just put in an amendment, the 28th Amendment, nine members only of the court. Done. Do you see that as a good thing, a reasonable thing? I mean, it's not easy to do, but would that end the turmoil that we're going through with this?
Well, maybe add at the same time term limits at the same time, so we wouldn't have these morbid health watches for octogenarian justices or politically timed retirements, that sort of thing. You know, that would only address one aspect of it, because fundamentally, I mean, there's been a lot of court reforms that have been proposed, some which require constitutional amendments, others that don't. But this is really nibbling at the margins, because the problem fundamentally isn't the process, it's that the Supreme Court is powerful because the federal government has centralized power, and then within Washington there's a skew away from Congress, which doesn't decide major controversies that much anymore. It passes everything to the executive branch, to the administrative agencies that come up with the rules and regulations by which we live our lives. So it's taken us decades to get to where we are, But long term, the only way to fix this and to kind of turn down the heat on nominations is to make what they're doing less important. Devolve power back to the states and the people, rebalance it within the federal government, that sort of thing. This is not an easy fix, obviously. I'm not saying that it's a magic bullet, but these process reforms, it'll help on the margins. But the real problem is the product of what the court works on.
So you're saying go back to the more possibly well-intended federalist model, where we're giving more control over more issues back to the states and not at the centralized level of Washington.
Yeah, I joke that the biggest constitutional amendment that we need is to add at the end of every provision, and we mean it.
Well, that would help certainly in a lot of cases. It seems to me, I mean, I don't know. They've said that obviously Mitch McConnell and Senator Graham would not have moved forward if they didn't think they had the votes. We knew there was a couple of Republican suspects, namely Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, that were going to vote no anyway. Mitch Romney came out and said he would support it. So it does seem like there's a vote issue here. I mean, if it gets to a vote, it's going to pass. And certainly, I guess the Democrats don't have any really procedural mechanisms that they can use to slow this down. So, I mean, what's going to happen at the end of the day when all these hearings are over?
Yeah, at this point, unless something, completely unexpected happens, I don't know, a big COVID outbreak so the senators can't meet at all.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows what, But at this point, Mitch McConnell does seem to have the votes. The quorum requirement is a majority, so 51, and apparently Mitch McConnell has that, even if none of the Democrats show up for the final vote. So at this point, I would expect Chairman Graham of the Judiciary Committee has already noticed the vote in the Judiciary Committee for a week from this Thursday, so a week after these hearings end.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can expect a vote on the Senate floor within a few days or within a week of that, which puts us within a week of the election. So that's the timeline.
We're speaking with Ilya Shapiro from Cato Institute. We've got a new book out called Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations and the Politics of America's Highest Court. Am I correct? Did I read or hear somewhere that there really is no stipulation even to have hearings? There's not like a constitutional requirement that we even have to have hearings like this?
That's right. It's just become a practice. It really, as I said, in 1916, there was a big controversy over the Brandeis nomination. They didn't have them for every single nominee after that. The first one to testify was Felix Frankfurter in 1938, but then they didn't have them necessarily for everyone after that. It started up for every nominee in the 50s when Southern Democrats were concerned about desegregation and other aspects of civil rights law, and so they wanted to question nominees over that. But now, in 1962, Byron White had an hour-and-a-half long hearing. He himself testified for about 15 minutes of it, mostly on questions about his football career. So things were a little different.
I had said that I thought initially, from what I read about Judge Barrett's background, that I thought this would become a kind of a religious litmus test, in a sense, and that they would go after the fact that she is part of not a traditional Catholic church, but she's part of a group of like-minded practicing believers, and that they would use that as some leverage to try to discredit her. I think I'm wrong. I don't see that coming up at this point because they seem like they've backed away from that. What's your take on that?
They're not really attacking her on religion because they noticed that that backfired 3 years ago when she was up for the Seventh Circuit and really turned her into a martyr, so to speak, elevated her national profile. And some outside groups are certainly attacking her religion or trying to portray her as weird or something like that, which I don't think is really effective. So they're playing a more conventional play of talking about her views or trying to get at her views on abortion and Obamacare, but I think that they're quickly realizing that there's no way to stop her, and they're trying to make a process argument. They're trying to make this about the presidential election, and and things like that, which is about as much as they could do. I mean, I haven't been surprised by anything yet that I've seen in this process.
Okay. I mean, and she again, she's just so pleasant in her mannerism and speech. I think they hurt themselves if they try to go after her personally, right? So they can't even, that's not even an opportunity for them.
Yeah. I mean, I think if she's confirmed, she might be able to be even more effective than her mentor, Antonin Scalia, just because there's no sharp elbows there. I mean, she's just behind the scenes. I think she could have sway over her colleagues.
She could be a force for sure. I'm thinking though, when she's, let's say she's confirmed, we assume that's what's going to happen, and it does seemingly cement the balance of the court more in a conservative or originalist model. How does that affect how we move forward? I mean, does it have that kind of a really cementing effect in the years to come? I mean, she's a young person. She's what, 51? Maybe Judge Thomas retires at some point. But I mean, does this really change, as much as people are saying, does this really change the dynamic of the court for long term?
Every justice makes for a new court, as Justice Byron White used to say. And I think that's right. Fundamentally, not just in, you know, counting, you know, 5-4 is going to go 5-4 the other way or become a 6-3. That'll happen in some cases, but the fact that John Roberts, the Chief Justice, will no longer be the immediate vote, that's going to change things, because mm-hmm. we've seen the last 2 years since Kavanaugh replaced Kennedy, and Kennedy was famously the swing, and Roberts is not the swing, he's just the middle, and so mm-hmm. gets to determine how far or how fast the court goes in any way, and now he won't be. And so I think the types of cases the court will take and you know, where it'll go with them definitely will change. And as I said, behind the scenes, I think just she'll have an influence. You know, even though she becomes the junior justice, I think she'll be very well respected. And also, the only one from the middle of the country, didn't go to Harvard and Yale. I mean, that kind of diversity as well. Mother of seven, first mother of school-age kids up on the court.
Yes.
You know, very different.
You can manage seven kids. You can manage a few Supreme Court justices.
I'm guessing. She called it her team of, you know, Kavanaugh called it the court, the team of nine. Well, she has her own team of nine at home.
All right. Hey, thank you so much for taking time out. I really appreciate having you on, and love your experience and your knowledge. Looking forward to reading the book, Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations and the Politics of America's Highest Court. Ilya Shapiro from the Cato Institute. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.